And then his mom's like, hey, little Johnny, do you want to go see the war and the Battle of Bunker Hill? And he's like, okay, mom. And they get like a little carriage and go to like... So yeah, at age 7, he just sees like war.
Welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, a podcast that digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. My name's Kyle, the Marilyn Monroe to Eric's John F. Kennedy. But before we dive into today... Sorry. Happy birthday, Eric. let's see. What did we do last week? Last week, we started from the end, and we actually covered Mr. John Quincy Adams' post-presidency and death. And today, since normally we cover the things that they do while they're actually the president, and as Eric has mentioned, there wasn't a whole lot that got done while Mr. John Q. was the president, so... Instead of talking about a bunch of stuff that didn't happen, we're just going to go back and talk about some of the things that we have already covered previous stories and just explore them in more detail.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Kyle. I mean, you hit it right in the head. There's an argument to be made. John Quincy Adams' least successful time of his life was being president, which is a wild statement to say for anybody.
Especially when you hear what we're going to talk about for the pre-presidency, and you combine that with the post-presidency.
Oh, I mean... His whole life before becoming president was just absolutely insane. It was just, we're talking about a guy who got the grand slam. Mm-hmm. So, senator, nominated to the Supreme Court, and president. All right, a guy who was a diplomat to almost a dozen countries. But it all starts on July 11th, 1767, in my hometown. Gonna make this about me. I'm gonna completely. Hijack this discussion and actually only talk.
Was it called Quincy when he was born?
It wasn't. It was called Braintree, and then it broke off. But you know what? The United States. Do you say George Washington wasn't born in the United States?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, right. If your family, it was his family that got together and voted to create Quincy.
Right.
Like that shouldn't be a positive thing that Braintree brags about. Like, oh, these people voted to form their own thing. I mean, come on, please. So he was...
Apologies to anybody from Braintree that's listening right now. For me, not for Merritt.
I lived in Braintree for a little bit. There's an old joke that goes back and forth between the two towns, because Braintree would be like, we have the birth certificates. And we're like, well, we have the estates and the death certificates.
Yeah.
It's very funny. Good local government joke there.
Right.
Just like his father, it's the only place you can go see. Founding father's original home, not one that's been rebuilt, not one that's, you know, that's modeled after. No, you can go hang out where John Quincy Adams was born.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the chair that his father died in. I've seen the boyhood home that he ran around and played in. Like, yeah, it's amazing the preservation that they've done there. Yeah, let's go back and let's start talking about some of the early stories then, because there's some stuff that we kind of just like glossed over. I remember when we talked about Abigail Adams, you mentioned something about her being like the first person to really do anything with like the smallpox vaccine.
Oh yeah, yeah. So it's funny. So back in the old days,
right?
Back in the old days, how did you have vaccinations, right? How did you protect yourself against diseases? So vaccination would really become more... The idea of what we think of a vaccine today didn't really become prominent until, you know, I think like the 1800s. I forget when it died. I know Louis Pasteur developed a rabies vaccine, but that was more like crushed up dead rabies, so it would then be... I think it was an inhalant. It was really sad because he actually developed it because he saw one of his best friends die of rabies from a dog bite. Oh, weird thing. I do like to question people. Like, yeah, I love throwing stats out at people, Kyle, as you know that. Kyle is going to embarrass me on a future episode and or short about presidential trivia. So just everybody like and subscribe if you want to see that. And you get humiliated and then never watch another one of these videos after I know nothing about the presidents without time to prepare and research. I often say I'm a very good researcher, but you got to give me time to learn.
I will point out though, the first question on that list that I had, I actually teased it. I used it last episode and you nailed it. The skinny dipping. John Quincy Adams being a skinny dipper. Yeah.
Question, do you think John Quincy Adams also skinny dipped in Furnace Brook that runs right by the house?
Oh, God, yeah. Anything. If you're going to swim naked in any body of water, you're going to swim naked in every body of water, right?
Ooh, out. You know what, Kyle, I agree with you 99% of the time, but if I'm willing to, you know, swim naked in the ocean, I'm not swimming naked in, like, the Amazon.
No, yeah, I mean.
So John Quincy Adams is one of the first people. I don't use the word inoculated. That's not the actual word. We'll get into a little bit of that detail. But
say vaccinated? Is that appropriate?
Verilation, I believe, is the term they would use.
Verily.
Hmm. Yes. Verilation is usually the term that's used.
Joel.
Joel!
You'll win this week.
So he gets inoculated, right? And he actually has a relationship to the doctor who brought this over to the United States. So John Quincy Adams. Sorry, we didn't say, usually we read off who his parents are, but like it's Abigail Adams and John Adams.
Oh, right? I wonder who,
yeah. Yeah, if you haven't picked up on that, like, you know, please watch our back catalog and comment the minute you figure out that Eric has said Abigail Adams or John Adams for the 40,000th time. And there will be 40,000 more, God willing. All right.
No,
but it was actually one of John Quincy Adams' mom, Abigail Adams' distant relatives, Zebdale Boylston. So Dr. Boylston's actually the guy who introduced the United States. He's related to the Adams family, very distantly related. And ironically, to the Boylston family would actually go on to sponsor a chair professorship position at Harvard that John Quincy Adams would eventually take in 1806. By that point, the families had separated so much that like it wasn't like somebody from the Boylston family said, oh, make sure JQA does this.
Hmm.
But yeah, so he introduces it to the United States. And so how we discovered it is there was people in Europe, there's doctors in Europe who observed that milkmaidens didn't really get or die from smallpox. It's because they got exposed to cowpox from milking right. Cows. Cowpox is less lethal. So somebody's like, wait a minute, what if I take a really weak strain or a very small amount of smallpox and give it to like a kid? Then I don't think they knew antibodies existed, but they knew that natural immunity could be produced, and so they would cut their skin and stick it in. Most of the time it was dead, but
like, how do you get a small amount of smallpox?
Oh, they would cut open a pox on somebody with smallpox and take it out of there.
Yeah, but how do you quantify how much is too much of that to stick into somebody's arm? That's the part I don't understand.
I don't think there was a scale here. A lot of people died during this process. But anyway, so this inoculation process goes through. And his mom, Abigail, is like really adamant about it because she believed in that science. It's kind of this precursor because a lot of Adams' life, he talks about, you know, for such a religious guy, for a guy on these moral principles and all this stuff, and we talked about last episode, he loves science, man. Like, he loves the study of the natural world. And also, just throwing out it, George Washington required all his troops to get inoculated against smallpox also.
Oh, really?
Was this after
Abigail? Because Abigail is the one who basically proved it works, right?
Yeah, Abigail was a big advocate for this. So yeah. Was Catherine the Great.
Oh, that's right. I remember hearing about that in the Great series that they have on, was that Hulu?
Yeah, it's on Hulu. Yeah,
that was a good series. I hope they bring that back.
Oh, hold on a second. Wait, real quick. I do want to say something. I want to put a little footnote here. You know, I brought up the cowpox
method. Yeah.
Cowpox based method would come about in 1796.
Mm-hmm.
So they had noticed the pattern already, but it was Edward Jenner who was the one who was like, oh crap, let's just use it from cows.
Right. Okay. Cool. So before that, they were using just weaker versions of the actual smallpox itself. Yeah.
All right, so John Adams, I mean, early life, he by the time he's 10, he's already fluent in French. He had a rigorous education at home. I mean, Abigail Adams was a brilliant woman. You know, she taught history and literature, scripture, and, you know, she very much stressed that you need to have a strong moral compass, and you need to be good at writing. And I don't know why, you know, I do know why, but I love that because he ends up journaling his entire life and we get to know so much about him. But
was your focus on that mostly because that's the main form of communication? Like, you just have to be able to clearly communicate your ideas.
Kyle, it's amazing how similar you and I are when it comes to how we think about this stuff. So when I was doing the research and homework for this, I actually kind of was like, why were people journaling so much? Like,
yeah.
Right, it doesn't seem weird that that was like a really, really big thing, and now it's not. And so I thought it had to do with like essentially practice writing. Like, we can just communicate so easily, and there's such a low frictional cost to communicate that oh, it's because it's a learned skill, and you want to be like scribes who are incredibly powerful for, you know, thousands and thousands of years.
You said you never really journaled, right?
No.
Yeah, so I've done a little bit of it, and what I've found it being very useful for doing, not just recapping like your day, but also like kind of putting some sense into some of the things that happened. It's another way of kind of like analyzing the events of the day and like how you want to improve going forward. And like it's a written record to go back and reference too. Like maybe I want to see like what happened during these days when I was feeling so great? Like how do I recreate this? I can go look back and see what happened during that time period.
Yeah, I think the reflective nature of it's amazing.
Right. So I think it's a lot of that. There's a lot of real benefits to journaling that just nobody really thinks about until you actually do it.
May I take a liberty for a second?
Oh, yes.
I think I'll take it out of my pocket. We should commission journals, and then we should have people email us, and I'll give 10 away.
Yeah.
I will make a The Buck Starts Here custom journal.
Yeah.
But here's the key. You have to send it back to us after a year and we get to read it.
That, and you also have to give us your top four presidents so I can make a Mount Rushmore for you to put on the cover.
I'm serious about the offer. I'm not serious about you guys have to mail it back. But I will, yeah. I will. If you email, Kyle, you want to plug the email address?
BuckStartsHerePodcast@gmail.com.
Yep. I will figure out a way, the first 10. I will first figure 10, out a way to get that out. I'm going to end up spending $70 in journals. Right. My poor wife's going to be, Eric, real quick.
Right. What is this expense?
What is this expense? Kyle, I'm with you. I think journal, it is awesome. So maybe it was just a way to be reflective. And that's how he used his journals his entire life.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that and just the record of it. I mean, you think, like now we're kind of spoiled with things like Facebook and like social media that kind of just keeps a track record of everything that you're doing in a digital footprint. Like we didn't have that before either.
Yeah.
All right.
Kyle, what's the most, let's talk about the most disturbing moments of our childhood. No, don't actually answer that, buddy. Okay. I wasn't trying to be It just gets really dark for a minute.
It's the time when my mom cut my arm open and shoved a festering. Oh, yeah.
as she's ranting about moral lessons to me.
Right.
No, the reason I say that is because at 7, his mom was like, hey, son, do you want to go see a war? And he was like, and they went and watched the Battle of Bunker Hill.
Right.
And I just think that's, you know what's crazy is that during the Civil War, everybody thought it was going to be like a gentlemanly affair. Mm-hmm. And so for the first couple of Civil War battles, people like picnicked and then watched people get like massacred.
And like lots of people get massacred.
So I think everything's the same. And, you know, people talk about like, oh, look how horrible the internet is. You can see all these gore videos. And I'm like, yeah, that's not my cup of tea. I don't want to watch that. I don't really see the appeal of it. But also people used to just go watch war. Yeah.
The Colosseum and gladiators. And
Yeah. People talk about, oh, phones are making young kids dumb because they have all the information there. It's like Socrates said books will make people dumb. Like, because they don't forget. Like everything's the same. We're all the same people. We're not that different now.
People thought the telephone was going to get rid of written communications.
Yeah. People thought TVs were going to destroy radio. Now radio, like, revenues are
right.
It's like some crazy number because you can't watch TV and drive. Trust me, I've tried. So, yeah, at age 7, he just sees, like, war.
Right.
Just war. And his mom takes him to see it. I got to imagine that. It was a weird conversation. I always imagine what happens, like, 3 hours before that. What do you do? Like, he's outside swimming. Yeah. Enjoying himself, playing with his animals, probably naked. And then his mom's like, hey, little Johnny, do you want to go see the war and the Battle of Bunker Hill? And he's like, okay, mom. And they like, get in like a little carriage and go to like...
Want to see your dad and his friends go shoot some Brits?
I don't know if John Adams was involved, but I get what you're saying.
No.
So eventually after that, you know, he's by 10, he's about fluent in French. He learned French during his father's diplomatic postings because, you know, they were over in France. Remember, this is the same time.
I didn't realize he went with them.
Oh, yeah. So he traveled with his dad. By 1778, so when he's about 11 years old, he's with his dad on diplomatic missions in Europe.
Okay.
He was a public servant his entire life. It's wild. Now, harping back real quick. Remember we were talking about Jefferson's daughter Polly coming over and being with the Adams family. That's this time. So John Quincy Adams around doing this.
So I actually had another question about that because I remember we talked about Jefferson kind of taking Madison under his wing. Like, why didn't he do that same thing with John? Or is it just because he had his dad that was qualified, well qualified to do the job?
Had his dad. Also, you were starting to see a little bit of the rift between them by this time.
There's,
I personally don't think they ever hate each other. I think personally they always loved each other. It was just outwardly. The other part is that I don't know if Jefferson and Adams would have gotten along. John Quincy Adams would have gotten along. Hey, Thomas Jefferson's really smart, don't get me wrong, but different level of towering intellect. I think there's a huge ego problem with Thomas Jefferson. I don't think Thomas Jefferson would have liked... Oh, here's the other thing. Like, we look at John Adams as, like, I don't know, sometimes, because he was the first president to ever have a picture taken of him. And I hope that was one of your trivia questions.
no. Nope. But it isn't. And won't be now.
It won't be now. So, and we think, and we see that picture of him, we see that painting of him in Congress, and when he's older. Dude, he was, like, big into physical fitness. He did physical fitness every day. He was built more like Theodore Roosevelt than he was like James Madison. So I think he wouldn't have wanted this, like, oh, I think he likes, I don't know, this is speculation, but Jefferson, I think, enjoyed having more malleable people around him. I don't think...
He wanted people looking up to him.
Yeah, I don't think John could down. So I'm like, hey, real quick, so you said, according to my notes here, you said all people are created equal. Yes, you have slaves. Would you care to address that?
Right.
And Jefferson would have been like, get away from me. And he would have been like, you're a bad farmer. Right. And John Quincy Adams would have left.
But that's another good point. We talked about his dad being a cobbler in addition to being a lawyer and all these other things. And so it's a completely different, like, mentality almost, right?
One of our best performing shorts. Everybody go listen to that. Yes. I just think it's cool that he can write you a constitution and make you a pair of shoes. I wish I had that talent.
Right.
So he's over in Europe at this point. He's fluent in French. He lived in Paris, Amsterdam, London during his formative years. He studied Latin. He attended the University of Leiden. He actually enrolled in a couple private academy in Paris. So he's very global at this point. And he started understanding how international politics work. He started seeing what true diplomacy. And then we get to the best part, which he starts journaling at age 11. And like I've said before, he maintains his whole life. And it's what's funny is everybody knew those journals existed, but it really wasn't until like the late 1800s to like today that we go back and look at, wait a minute, this guy was journaling. He was transcribing a lot of documents at this point because he could speak two languages. And we're like, what if we went back and looked at his... It sounds weird to think reading a 12-year-old's diary is going to tell you about European affairs, but then you forget that this isn't a normal 12-year-old. This is John Quincy Adams. Like, this is the guy.
He's like only 2 years from being a diplomat.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
One of my favorite Futurama jokes is when they talk about the election of the first robot president, and it was John Quincy Adams' machine. So he promised not to destroy all humans, but, you know, like most politicians, he overpromised. Big Futurama fan.
I think I do remember that one.
It's a great one. So,
yeah.
Kyle, if you'll entertain me for a minute, I want to do just a nice little quick rundown of him and his father.
Yeah.
Because John brought him over. They actually had to sneak out of Quincy. They had to go over to Howe's Neck, which is one of the two peninsulas that's in Quincy, to catch a ship to get around the British blockade at night. So this is 1778. John Adams is, basically he's sent over her to negotiate. John Adams, the father, he's sent over to negotiate a treaty and secure French support for the Revolutionary War. John Quincy Adams comes with them, and they travel aboard a boat called the Boston, and it's captained by this guy, John Manley. John Manley's a cool little... He's a cool guy. This is JQA and his dad. They're over in Paris, and he actually meets Ben Franklin. And him and Ben Franklin actually get along great. Franklin, like 11-year-old, like it's Ben Franklin. He gets along with everybody.
We have not done anything with Ben Franklin yet.
We could just do endless amounts on everything about Ben Franklin.
I know, right?
One of the things JQA remarked on in his journals was he really was impressed by Franklin's charisma and his diplomacy. It affected how he viewed diplomacy. But it's funny because he also writes about how his dad used to criticize Benjamin Franklin for his lack of work ethic. And I think in the John Adams series, he mentioned some of the comments John Adams used to say about Ben Franklin, but he was Big Ben. For a guy who writes early to bed, early to arise, makes him strong, wealthy, and wise, he goes, you do neither of those things. We're afraid because you wake up at like noon, go into town, hold concert with fellow adoring people.
Have some libations.
Like, yeah, libations. If read Ben Franklin's autobiography, I'm surprised it's not banned in some schools.
Really? A lot of debauchery?
Oh, it's not just debauchery. It's certain ways he describes it that you're just like, huh. I'm not joking. I think this would like get age-restricted on YouTube if I went into just like some very mild parts of it.
Really?
Oh, yeah. His autobiography is one of the best books ever. It is better than a rock star's autobiography because it's like, oh, not only is this... Like, you're reading one of the founding fathers on top of, like, just the crazy stuff he did his entire time.
Okay, well, yeah, we're going to have to do a Patreon on this once we get that figured out.
Yeah.
Where we can swear.
So, JQA and Papa Adams, they return in 1779. The trip basically got cut short because you had the French were kind of already going to be against the Brits. And we had started putting together a much more prolific, what ended up being called... effectively the second European mission. So John Adams, he was appointed to the Minister of the Netherlands to secure loans and recognition of independence. So John Quincy Adams accompanies his dad over there. He's 12 years old at this point. And they end up staying over there for 5 years. So most of his early teenage years, he's in Europe. And he studied at the Latin School of Amsterdam. And by the time he's 12 years old, he's fluent in several different languages. He understands the European, what would eventually become the European concert system. He's helping transcribe different notes. So he probably understands what's going on in the world better than almost anybody besides maybe John Adams and Ben Franklin and possibly Thomas Jefferson. Washington's over there leading an army. Like he's not like interlocked with the geopolitical side. He's leaving those guys to go do that.
Right.
And he spends a lot of time at The Hague, which is funny because later on in his life when he's the diplomat, the minister to Amsterdam, he spends more time at The Hague. But by this time, the Dutch Republic has fallen and he describes his time in The Hague as very lonely in his life. But then he gets his first diplomatic mission. He gets his first diplomatic mission in 1781. So he's 14 years old. Gets an official diplomatic mission with this guy, Francis Dana. And they end up going to St. Petersburg in Russia. And they're trying to get support of Russia for recognizing the U.S. Well, actually, it ends up going bad. It doesn't work that well because basically Francis Dana, who's actually a very competent person, they don't have a letter signed by a monarch. So Russia declined to recognize the U.S. Because they didn't have a letter signed by a monarch. He returns back to Western Europe for the next couple of years. He was actually with his father during the Treaty of Paris negotiations. Though he wasn't directly involved, he translated a lot of stuff and would actually sit there and listen to like John Jay, Henry Lawrence, and Richard Oswald, debate what this is going to look like. So you have this like 15, 16-year-old who's seeing firsthand how you negotiate stuff. You can see why he negotiates every treaty essentially for the United States afterwards.
Well, we know John Jay was damn good at that too.
I do love John Jay.
So... You said that his first posting, his first job at age 14, they'd sent somebody with them, but is that like almost insulting to have like a 14-year-old being sent to your court to negotiate something with you?
So it's a point, it would be, absolutely, is that Francis Dana was the minister, but John Quincy Adams, it was an official posting because he was told, you go with Francis Dana, and he basically served as his secretary.
Right, okay, so it wasn't like he was the... leading negotiator of whatever this group was. That's such a baller move. Like they should have sent him to go negotiate the surrender of Britain.
It is funny though, because at this point when they're traveling, they go through Switzerland and John Quincy Adams is like, wow, the Alps are crazy. He's just like, I don't know why. I love the humanity of that. He's just He's like, dude, did you guys see this? It's crazy. Like, there's no trains or anything. So he's just like on a road and just go through the Alps. And the biggest mountains he ever saw were like the Blue Hills, which is like the northern portion of the Appalachian Mountains. So you have these like really old weather. I mean, the Appalachian Mountains are older than the rings of Saturn. That's how old
they
are. And you have like the Alps. And he's like, damn, guys, you see this thing? Crazy. His time in Europe comes to an end. And he was good. He was an efficient diplomat. He was he ended up learning while he was over there 8 different languages.
That's crazy.
So he knew English.
Yeah.
He learned Latin. He learned French. He learned Dutch. He learned German, Greek. And then he also learned Spanish. I didn't count English in my first one because obviously he didn't learn English over there. But he learned Spanish and Italian and actually picked up Russian, even though he was only there for a few months.
Damn. So most of those are all Latin-based, right? So it's not like he's learning Cantonese, too, or anything like that.
No, I don't know.
No, I'm just kidding. I'm not going to take away from somebody who speaks eight languages. I don't know
what Russian is based.
That's a Slavic language. That's,
yeah, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's... No, it's impressive however you look at it.
Yeah, weird that you're throwing flack at him for only knowing 8 languages on top of English.
No, that's because I'm American.
Cantonese is such an amazing response.
I know, like, QBasic. That's, like, the only other language I know.
I'm still trying to master English, if I'm being honest with you.
I know, right?
I don't know if that counts. Like, programming. That's fun. Yeah. I like programming. So he comes back. He comes back to America when he's 18, enrolls in Harvard. They actually enroll him as a junior because they're like, "Wow, you're like, dude, imagine like going to apply to get into college, and you're like, yeah, I was a diplomat, and they're like, you're 18. It's like, yeah, but I was. Are you familiar with the United States? Like, I was part of that. Like, oh, right. Okay. Also, my dad went here. Your dad, who is the John Adams, your dad? Yeah, yeah.
So how long did it actually take him to get a degree?
2 years. Yeah. He graduated when he was 20.
Yeah.
It's funny, he was, it was actually mostly classical, everybody knows he's an attorney, right?
Yeah.
But he actually studied liberal arts, and then a little bit with a concentration on like political theory. It's cool, he studied on this guy, Theophilus Parsons, who was this like major prominent federalist jurist. And future Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Court, and there's still stuff in this like around the city named around the state named after him, and he ends up becoming his like his mentor, and really teaching him how to practice law, because at this time his father's vice president and is down in New York or Philly, where it'd be I think New York at this time, because they're still transitioning over.
Not at the Senate, obviously.
Yeah, not in the Senate yet. Though that's very very quick. So. He starts practicing law in Boston, but doesn't really love it. He's good at it, but he never really developed his own private legal practice because he saw himself as a diplomat and later a civil servant.
Right. But
one of my favorite things that Cal and I talked about, we hinted about it last show, is that he starts publishing under pen names.
Yeah.
And he's a funny guy. So one of them is Publicola, is a pen name, a pseudonym he uses in 1791.
What is it? Publicola?
Yeah, it's all one word. Publicola is probably how the Latins.
Okay, so not like a Coca-Cola knockoff.
No, yes. Right.
It's like the first Pepsi.
And so he starts writing stuff, responding to Thomas Paine and Edmund Burke, and critique. And you know, at one point he writes something defending Edmund Burke's conservative critique of the French Revolution, because at this point the French Revolution is going a little nuclear. We haven't reached real nuclear levels yet, but this is when people are like, "So you're telling me you formed an oligarchy and now you want 10 days in a week?" And one of the dudes dressed in a toga and tried to like light a candle or light like a torch at the top of like some giant structure. This doesn't really seem like you guys lost the cause at some point.
This doesn't sound like liberty.
If you're like, "Hey guys, let's get rid of the king," and then like a couple of years later you got some guy dressed up in a toga like trying to light a torch, you're like, whoa guys, we something happened there. Let's just pause. Nobody's wrong.
I feel like we just crossed paths at some point here.
Yeah, this is clearly a misunderstanding. Nobody's right or wrong here. Like that was
reset.
Yeah, that wasn't Edmund Burke's argument, but it was kind of Edmund Burke's argument. It was like, guys, you drove past it. But basically, at this time, all the stuff he's writing, he writes as another pseudonym is Columbus and Marcellus. And a lot of times he's actually, funny to what we mentioned earlier, he's authoring critiques of Jeffersonian views and defending Washington's policies on neutrality, and generally just overly comically trying to defend. And when I say comically, I mean like he was trying to be funny as he's doing it.
Yeah. Satirical.
Really, yeah, I would say borderline satirical, very Voltairic.
Yeah.
Defending constitutionality and the idea of constitutions.
Yeah.
He gets his full appointment when he gets sent to the Netherlands in 1794, and He was nominated by his father. He was recommended by his father, and the Secretary of State, Edmund Randolph. And then people were like, "Oh, why'd you put him over there?" And he was like, "He's also fluent in Dutch at this time." People were like,
All right,
he's wicked young. He's comically right. young at this point. Like this is like a 27-year-old they're sending over there.
Has he done the eye roll journal yet?
No, I wrote journals about 1822-ish, 1821. It's part of
Madison's cabinet, right?
Yeah.
Madison or Monroe?
Monroe.
Monroe, yeah.
And I just love that one.
I know.
So he goes over there. It's horrible, man. It's horrible when he's over there. He's 27. He's still one of the youngest diplomats ever appointed, and specifically to a major power or a major ally.
Is he married at this point?
Yeah. No, he marries when he's 30.
Okay.
Single
in Dutch also, or single in Europe.
Yes, let me double check that. I want to say it's 30 he gets married at.
1797.
Yeah, 1797, he's 29, she's 22.
Alright, awesome. Yeah.
She's awesome. Louisa Catherine. She becomes like she ends up hosting all these fancy parties and stuff, and it is cool. All right.
So he got posted back in the Dutch Republic. Is this because you mentioned the fall, I think, earlier. Is this before or after the fall, then?
So this is during the fall of the Dutch Republic. So the Dutch Republic, it's formed in 1581. It's called the Republic of the Seven United Netherlands. I always think that's funny. It's the Netherlands, but they actually mean, like, plural lands.
Right.
Like, that's kind of cool. It's not cool, but I think it's kind of cool.
Also, yes. Something that we kind of talked about in the one of the very first episodes, I think we mentioned, I feel like it deserves to be mentioned, but I feel like the Dutch kind of had some sort of influence on the way this whole country was kind of formed. At least their tolerance towards religious persecution and the acceptance of immigration.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they very much viewed themselves on a much more, like, egalitarian perspective. They were much more this idea of, like, you know, these core fundamental Republican beliefs.
Yeah. So we learned when the Puritans, before they came over to land in Boston, they actually were in the Dutch Republic for quite a bit of time. Preparing for that, right?
Yeah, saving up money and getting ready for the crossing. So what is, you end up having, like, the Dutch Revolt in 1851, and this is kind of a product of the 80s year, which war against Spain. So, yeah. 1581 comes around, they free themselves from King Philip II of Spain, and they decide to have the seven provinces, which I'm not going to try and pronounce, but Holland's one of them, and then it's a bunch of words that Eric is not going to be able to pronounce because I'm not Dutch. They get together and they form this centralized government. It's incredibly weak, and each one of the seven regions includes their own autonomy, basically, their own government.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very weird because the rest of the, like, Europeans were like, "What are you doing? Where's your king? Can you have a king, please?" But it was funny because all the states had their own different, like, governments. Like, one of them was like an oligopoly. Others had, like, town councils. Other had, like, basically,
there's nothing really unifying them.
Yeah,
other than maybe heritage.
But the guy who sat at the top of the republic, he was basically appointed as a military leader, but he wasn't a monarch. He was there to run the military.
Mm-hmm.
But it works. They end up becoming stupid wealthy. They found the Dutch East India Company, VOC, and the Dutch West Indies Company. Amsterdam becomes the bank capital of the world, one of the trading capitals of the world. You end up with Rembrandt, Vermeer. They become, you know, these leaders in art and philosophy. Spinoza is at this time. And the Dutch Navy becomes just comically powerful. And they're known not just for their religious tolerance, but their intellectual tolerance.
Right.
And this leads to this weird thing called entrepreneurialism, which, I mean, who would have ever guessed that you could take a system, a country, and you allow people to have freedom, and you're going to get other people who show up who are going to, you know, try and develop better processes that create more jobs and more efficient uses of capital, and that somehow weirdly is going to, you know, cause people to have more money that they can then invest in other things, which will then create more jobs and more opportunities. I mean, that just seems insane. That's certainly not how the economy is supposed to work. It's not supposed to just be a free-flowing ideas. So naturally, all these people want to destroy this system, because why wouldn't you, as a monarch, Why wouldn't you want to destroy something that shows that everybody living underneath your totalitarian control could A, be freer and richer? Why would you want that to exist? So in the late 17th century, and going into the 18th century, they start having this internal strife between the Republicans, the guys who support the current system, and these guys, Orangeists, which are from the House of Orange. It's basically trying to reestablish the monarch.
What lunatic is calling for that system to come back? That's what I don't get.
Ironically, the stadtholder, like the head of the military, because it's it's not elected. It's kind of like inherited by this House of the Orange. They want more power.
Yeah, okay.
They faced a bunch of wars with France and then later, with England and France. There's a Franco-Dutch War that lasted like 6 years. There's a Spanish War of Succession, which is a crazy topic. Anybody, listeners, if you ever want it, I think Extra History does a series on the Spanish Succession, the War of Spanish Succession. It is crazy. It is just wild.
Is that the one that like their king got like reinstated and like moved around? There's something weird that happened with like the monarchy over there, wasn't there?
Yeah, it's a dying empire trying to revive itself.
Right.
Like, it's just absolutely wild. This is also when the tulip bubble occurs.
Which
kind of like destroyed their economy. So, I think it was like the 1730s.
The second speculative crash.
We had the Mississippi bubble, but I think that was.
You said the Mississippi bubble was first, right?
Yeah, I think the Mississippi bubble was a little earlier.
Yeah.
It started earlier, exploded later.
Yeah, I think we talked about it.
Basically, this leads to stagnation. Obviously, stagnation is the worst thing that can happen to political stability. Boom, collapses. And Adams is there the whole time. He's writing back to America, but it basically creates a sad time in Adams' life because he can't do anything. He's not really advocating. He's not really helping anything. And then
So he's just watching this thing collapse, and there's nothing he can really do about it.
Yeah, and he'll go on to have many other interesting missions throughout Europe at the time. But it's all kind of the same. He's doing the same thing. He's reporting. He's affirming America's dignity. It was a term that was often used. He was seen as just a great diplomat.
He's also doing things like sitting in dark corners and reporting on conversations as he eavesdropped on too, right? I think you said.
Yeah, kind of. He was like America's like first spy.
Yeah,
and in some cases, he was just like listening on stuff and he had an insane memory. He was writing all the time. he goes to Prussia and his esteem begins to grow. It begins to grow. So he goes over to Prussia. When he's over in Prussia, he has court access to King Wilhelm. So when he came in there, I believe it was King Frederick Wilhelm II. That was obviously Frederick Wilhelm III. But both of them gave him court access, so he was just able to walk into their offices. He ends up developing a good relationship with Catherine the Great when he gets over to Russia. But it's a little different by this time. He's not there too long. He ends up being there for about a year or so. Jefferson comes into power. He resigns because he knows Jefferson's not going to reappoint him. Though there is some people who think Jefferson would have kept him.
I mean, it's hard to argue against the competence, right?
Yeah. So he comes back, 1801. He literally runs a practice for like a couple months. And he gets elected to the Massachusetts State Senate.
Wait a second. Remember how contentious that election was?
Yes, 1801.
Yeah, so maybe it was more about just an FU to Jefferson. Like, I don't want to work with this guy. He called my dad a hermaphrodite.
that's a pretty fair take, actually. I like that. I do it. You know what, Kyle? I'm with you on this. That was a screw you. I'm not going to be part of the administration. I'm taking my talents elsewhere.
Yeah.
That's it. I like that one. So he comes back. He gets elected to the state senate in Massachusetts a year later. At this point, senators aren't directly elected. Senators are elected through the legislative branch of their respective state. He gets elected to the Senate, the U.S. Senate at this point. And he's there for 5 years, but he actually resigns. He doesn't do much when he's up there because the Federalist Party, he took office as a Federalist senator, though he was very open that he was ideologically independent. Mm-hmm. That caused tension with party leadership. He ends up getting like real into these like he's at odds with the leadership, but also the anti-Jeffersonian people, he's also not a huge fan of it. So then the Jeffersonians, he supports some of the Jeffersonian measurements, but not a bunch of them. Like, he supports Louisiana Purchase and some neutrality clauses, but he's just independent on everything. So the at this point, the Democratic Republicans are not really split yet. They're still just Jeffersonians. So they like him because he's voting for him, but they're not going to welcome him to the Democratic Republican Party. Look at his name. Look at who he is. He's not welcome here. The Federalist Party hate these dudes, pretty much hate him, but their party's dying anyways. So he's like, I'm not going to get reelected. So he just resigns in 1808.
It's just amazing that he got elected. Sounds like he pissed everybody off.
But again, it's that he's super competent.
Right, right.
So he goes back, practices law for a couple of years. He gets really happy. He gets appointed. Like I mentioned earlier, he gets appointed. He's a professor at Harvard. It's probably some of the happiest moments of his life. He gets married to Louisa Catherine. Yeah, so this, so him and Louisa are kind of getting in their groove. They start having kids around this time. He does have
that's what you call the groove.
So Louisa Catherine is a really one of the most interesting first ladies. I wouldn't say she was the exact opposite of John Adams, because she was very intelligent, but she was this, I mean, she's described as bubbly and outgoing, and she's described as just like kind of like the
kind of a dolly, almost
like a dolly.
Yeah.
But like this caricature of what you think the perfect first lady would be. She hosts all these events. Even when she passed away, like, it was to the point where it was like a president passed away. But she would host parties even when John Adams wasn't there. She hosted women's groups. She was awesome.
Yeah.
She was the life of every party. And she'd try and get John Quincy Adams to join in. It was almost kind of funny. It was like, she would try and get him to join in, but he's like, oh, he's like the grouchy guy. But he's like, oh, my wife needs me to be here. I'm going to set the table and be polite. Like,
I'll set the table, but I'm not dancing.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. So they get married in London in 1797. She's 22. He's 29.
Was he stationed over there, or did they just decide to go to London to get married?
Yeah, so her father, Joshua Johnson, he's this like wicked prominent American merchant, and he's also the first consul in London.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so that's why,
because needed him to be the,
and not counting our current first lady, she was the only foreign born first lady. Really? So I know we don't do modern politics, but yeah, she was foreign born. She was born in England.
Really? I didn't know that.
That used to be a good, oh, so I've been one foreign born first. That used to be a good trivia question.
I wonder if that now was everybody can name one. I hope that wasn't in my trivia question.
They were, they were just one of those very similar dynamic to Abigail and John, with very loving ego. But they traveled so much. But Louisa traveled with them. Abigail didn't travel. Traveled a lot with John Adams, but not to the level that Louisa traveled with John Quincy Adams. And she had really bad health. Unfortunately had multiple miscarriages throughout their marriage. She was always. She felt a lot of pressure when she was on diplomatic missions to be the diplomat's wife.
And right.
She said that was part of the package. Like, and so that's service. And like in my mind, that's civil service, right? Like she was trying to show outwardly that what the United States represent. And they did have, they are very open about, they had a lot of mutual respect. John Adams has had four children who were born alive. The one, Louisa Catherine Adams, who was their daughter, she did die at infancy. She died about a year old.
Mm-hmm.
But their first child, George Washington Adams, which is a great name, just for the record.
Yeah, that's cool.
He ends up dying of suicide when he's in his late 20s. He went, he drowned. But a lot of
how they know the time, it was suicide?
I actually have it right here. He suffered with mental health and alcoholism. It's widely believed by historians to have been a suicide while Adams was serving in Congress. That's really all dipping. I have on that.
I mean, he could have just been drunk and doing what his dad did.
I think that's what it may have been. Then there's John Adams II. He actually served as private secretary to his father, but he ended up dying when he was 31 from alcoholism.
Jeez.
But he was known to be getting in public fights, including he once got in a brawl at a White House reception. Now, the one I did tell you about, the one who compiled all his dad's life's work, Charles Francis Adams.
Okay.
And he lived a very long life, lived to be about 80. He became a distinguished diplomat and historian, actually served as the U.S. Minister to Britain during the Civil War, was also a fairly successful businessman.
Something sad about outliving your kids, isn't it?
Yeah. And he would outlive all but Charles Francis.
Yeah. That's kind of awful, actually.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's just very sad.
Yeah.
So after John Adams goes into public practice for a little bit, he always felt invigorated in public service. He talks about in his time in Congress, he felt, re-energized and, that he was going to do good. But in 1811, he gets nominated by James Madison to the Supreme Court.
Okay, good. I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to ask why he turned that down.
So, very interesting. It is honestly one of the funniest reasons. He just says, I'll get bored being Supreme Court Justice. I want to do other things. So it's funny because Justice William Cushing passes away. And obviously, if everybody owns a lifetime appointment, Adams was only 43 at the time.
Has anybody ever retired as a justice? Or did they always do it until they die?
No, we've had justices retire, but they mostly...
If you're going to get bored, just do it for 5 years and then retire.
There's only been five who have ever turned it down. Yeah, John Quincy Adams in 1811. And he turned it down for what I just said. He preferred active public life. Robert H. Harrison, he actually turned one of the first nominated people for it, 1789. He was in horrible health at the time. He just was like, he felt it was a disservice to the country. Caleb Cushing, he was nominated by Ulysses S. Grant. And so these are all people who were confirmed by the Senate but didn't take it. Not people who were nominated withdrew because that gets a lot more.
Okay, okay.
He withdrew because there was all this controversy on his thoughts, his pre-Civil War sympathies for the South. And so he was just like, I don't want to deal with this. we have Roscoe Conkling. He was nominated under Chester A. Arthur. He accepted. He was all ready to go, but pretty much was making too much money. As a private attorney, was like, ooh, I don't want to do this. And then there's a handful of other ones who are kind of great, who are kind of gray line. But there's only been about 116 justices since then,
right?
And so we only have five who ever turned it down.
It's crazy that there's that few. It seems like there'd be a lot more, right?
Yeah, they last forever, dude.
I know. All right. Let's see. Is there anything else that we need to say or wrap up on here?
Well, no. He stays with his public life up until he becomes. He gets involved in presidential administrations, and we'd see that under shortly after this with Monroe, and we already know the story of him being the Secretary of State. But no. Next we'll talk about is what did the economy look like? What were some of the impacts that was going around in the world during his very stale presidency?
In fact, maybe I think that'd probably be... That actually sounds like a really interesting subject matter because we haven't really talked about the fighting, the things that go on behind the scenes, oppose all the stuff that you're trying to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is just one of the worst one of the best examples of how bad it can be.
Right, right. So, yeah, that'll be really interesting when we get to that. So, yeah, join us next week when we start diving into the not-so-notable events that define Mr. John Quincy Adams' presidency. In the meantime, though, shoot us a message. What do you think about the childhood of this guy? I mean,
are you interested in journaling son, now?
Yeah. Oh, that's a good... Yeah. Are you going to start journaling now? Have you started...
You could become a very forgotten president, but a very important historical figure by journaling.
Yeah. 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 It may not help you now, but it could help you in 200 years. email us at chinashopproductions@gmail.com if you want to get one of those journals that Eric has put up for offer. You can also visit the website at buckstartsherepodcast.com to stay up to date with everything we do. And we will see you all next week. Produced by China Shop Productions.